I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University, usually in Fremantle. Martin, where are you today?
I'm in Fremantle, very much so.
Well, that's good to hear. You probably watched or were at the great win that Fremantle Dockers had last night over the Essendon Bombers, Martin.
I think it's at five in a row. So they're doing pretty well.
Martin, Donald Trump would be just loving this because I think it's his modus operandi. He's on everybody's lips. And of course, the question is, can he broker some sort of, if not peace, some sort of stalemate, some sort of something in this conflict between Israel and Iran? He hasn't brought a halt to the Ukrainian war yet. He hasn't yet turned Gaza into a Trump world extravaganza. What can he possibly do in the case of Iran? I should point out it. Everybody knows that at this time of the day on Friday, still Thursday in the US, President Trump has said that he will decide whether the United States will attack Iran within the next 2 weeks, adding that he thought there's a substantial chance of negotiations that may or may not take place with Iran in the near future. Most of that in his quotes. It got me thinking, Martin, just what does Trump think about negotiations? He's famous, of course, for a television show, The Art of the Deal, and he wrote a book. According to Donald Trump, in The Art of the Deal making is a kind of personal art form rooted in instinct, boldness, and relentless self-promotion. He emphasizes thinking big, using leverage, and always protecting the downside. For Trump, success comes from trusting your gut, creating buzz, and negotiating from a position of strength. It's less about money and more about winning and keeping the score. And I have to say, when I went back and read that from The Art of the Deal, it resonates with just about everything he's done in this presidency. What do you think?
I think it's not a bad analysis. It's not a bad place to start from. A lot of people see this as really strange, and he's keeping everyone guessing. Certainly, he's the center focus of so much of this, and I think he kind of likes that. And he had a smile on his face. He says, "Maybe I will, maybe I won't." And we're talking about war here, by the way, and potential death of goodness knows how many people, particularly if Iran reacted to a US strike by attacking US assets in the region. It's a high risk business. But I think part of the words you read out there probably make some sense in this context. He sees himself as occupying a position of strength because he's got the threat of force, and he's trying to strong arm Iran into coming to the table and making a deal. The question is whether he overexits, because I don't think it's when you're trying to cut a deal, you don't call for the other person to unconditionally surrender. Remember, most politics is domestic. So if he wants to bring Iran to the table, Iran needs to feel that it's got some sense of agency here. Because he's got to be very careful there, because if Iran just rejects the deal and he goes ahead and strikes, which 99% of people seem to think would be an awful idea, myself included, because of the potential fallout across the whole region. Those of us have been around for a little while, Michael, we remember Iraq. We were told there were weapons of mass destruction. No one later found any. And even though that regime, like the current Iranian regime, was a pretty awful regime, the fallout, the transaction cost of trying to force regime change was awful. And the US found itself targeted and a quagmire, and many US soldiers lost their lives. So even if he doesn't care about Iranian lives, he should care about the lives of his soldiers throughout the Middle East, who could be impacted by this. They are quite vulnerable. They've still got a range of assets in Iraq, which is a Shia dominated country, and which the Grand Ayatollah of Iraq is close to the Iranian regime, and it said that that wouldn't be acceptable. So there's a whole range of potential fallouts here that he should be very, very carefully considering before he made a decision to strike.
Martin, I've tried to put myself in the position of the Ayatollah running the regime in Iran. Why wouldn't he just call Donald Trump's bluff? Does Trump really want to engage in this war as you've just described it? Does he really want it to be murky? Does he want to lose half his MAGA base in the US? Does he want to risk the fallout from the Middle Eastern countries who are perhaps a bit ambivalent about what's happening? What about China? What about Russia? What about his European quote unquote allies?
There's so many considerations. You've rattled off a few of them there. I think the one that he probably does have some consideration for is not so focused on his allies, but I think he does care about his MAGA base. And he's consistently advocated for the US staying out of Middle Eastern wars and not being caught up in them. He was a critic of the Iraq war himself. That's very appealing to a lot of his MAGA base, which is all America first. So he would be thinking about that, no doubt. There's a few neocons. These are hawkish people that have always wanted to destroy Iran in a Republican base. There was a fascinating interview with Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson. These are two fairly right-wing people, and Carlson's opposed to it and Cruz in favor of it. But it emerged that Ted Cruz didn't know how many people lived in Iran and had no idea of the ethnic makeup and a lot of basic facts about the country that he was advocating the US bomb. So there is no unified opposition to the Iranian regime. So you're not going to get a transition, a smooth transition to something else. So yeah, there's so many imponderables.
I think Cruz comes from Texas, doesn't he? He probably doesn't think there's anywhere else in the world, but, so he doesn't need to know the answer to Carlson's question. But there's another aspect to all of this, Martin. We're now focusing on will or won't the US go in and use their big bomb and try to blast this apparent nuclear bomb-making facility out of the deep ground. But whether he does or whether he doesn't, what will Israel do? Will they just keep the fight up? Will it just become another local skirmish if America doesn't involve itself and just go on for the next year or two or three? How long's Gaza been going? What will
Yeah,
happen?
it's a good question. I think it's a different perspective from their point of view. So you've got to remember this is in the context of decades of open hostility between those two countries. And Iran has funded Hamas and Hezbollah, two of the entities that have consistently attacked Israel and various sides. So having degraded their military capacity, Israel thinks they can go after the head honcho himself, so to speak. And attack them while they're vulnerable. And Iran is vulnerable militarily at the moment. It doesn't have some of the other pieces in place to attack, to return the fight against Israel. And Israel appears to have achieved military superiority in the air, which is a significant advantage. They have better technology. So they're winning in one sense militarily, but they haven't been able to stop Israel, Iran, of course, attacking them with their missiles. We've just seen missiles attack a number of civilian and political targets as well in Tel Aviv. So there is a price that the Israeli people are paying for all this too.
It is interesting. I noted that one of the Iranian missiles finished up hitting a hospital, and they seem to have apologized, saying that they were meaning to hit a military target. And maybe that's true. I mean, we all know that there's a whole lot of casualties on the side in warfare. But Martin, can I turn from what is an actual conflict and might become an even bigger one, Israel-Iraq, US, to the nearly forgotten conflict, Ukraine, Russia. There's a lot happening there still.
Yeah, so in Russia, it probably suits Russia to some degree to have conflagration in other areas because the spotlight's not on them. Russia continues to pound Ukraine, particularly focusing a lot on civilian targets, and that's they're using a lot of drone warfare, a lot of missiles as well. So Russia's had a small degree of success in taking back some territory from Ukraine in recent weeks, but that conflict's far from resolved. And instead of getting pressured by the US to come to the table, the US's focus is in a completely different direction. I should say, though, Michael, Russia would be very perturbed about the possibility of the Iranian regime collapsing, because they're a key ally. They've supplied them with drones. They've helped them in the war effort as well. So they've already lost Syria as a key ally, and if they lost Iran, that would be a blow to them.
Did you see the suggestion, I think, from President Trump that Putin might be a good person to come in and negotiate between Iran and Israel?
Well, look, one thing I'll agree with him on, he does appear to have a better relationship with Putin, Trump and Putin, than other presidents did. Some of us would like him to press Putin more on Ukraine and leverage that relationship more effectively. But nevertheless, that relationship does exist. And it would be in Putin's interest for a peace deal there too, because he would rather see a peace deal with the Iranian regime intact than perhaps the US to get involved in direct military action. And who knows where that might lead.
So, slipping back to Ukraine, I mean, what can we expect? I'm expecting that Ukraine's going to land a big bomb on some important installation of some sort in Russian territory before long.
Yeah, I think it's in a bit of a stalemate at the moment. I can't see it changing enormously, particularly while Trump's focus and attention is elsewhere. That European leaders are very determined to keep Zelensky supported, and he's got a limited number of support there. And I think probably you'll see Trump focusing on Israel and Iran in the short term. And probably getting back to looking at Ukraine at some stage down the future. It could be a month or two away, at least, could be 3 months.
Martin, if Ukraine, Russia, Ukraine is the nearly forgotten conflict, then we must say that Gaza is the forgotten conflict. What's happening now? Because it's not sleepy exactly, is it?
No, and there's still ongoing attacks, and there's aid is still an issue in Gaza, and the people there are very much still struggling and finding life incredibly difficult at the moment. And there's not any resolution to that conflict at all, as it stands. So you've got Israel off fighting with Iran, but on its doorstep, you've still got the Gaza problem, which remains completely unresolved.
Martin, as many of our listeners and readers of FSN will know, I quite recently am back from a break in Turkey and Greece. The one thing that I was reminded of while I was there is that we humans, since almost time immemorial, have been annihilating each other when we're given the chance. We have a break for a few years, we get a potentate, we get a powerful regime, we get a dynasty, but we all finish up annihilating each other. And I can't see that anything is any different on the ground today in these areas, just these areas we've been talking about. We don't need to go to Africa or anywhere else in the world. I mean, are you as pessimistic as I am about the likelihood of any of these significant conflicts being resolved adequately?
Oh, well, it's quite an interesting point. I think what someone once said, if aliens were looking down on us, Michael, they'd be astonished by our capacity to eliminate ourselves from the planet in many, many different ways. Probably chief amongst them warfare, but what we're doing in the environment and a range of other things as well. So one can't be a complete optimist. I think there are pl still plenty of voices around the table urging restraint and trying to get this situation re resolved diplomatically. The very latest missive that Donald Trump might take 2 weeks to resolve this appears to indicate that he's going to go back to the Iranians and at least offer them some kind of deal to prevent military action. Whether they take that or not, I'm not sure. But that would appear to suggest that he's not going straight in just yet.
Well, Martin, the rest of us, of course, continue to live our lives. I've already commented on some of the important news to so many people. The win of the Dockers last night at Optus over the Essendon Bombers, and it's still raining in Fremantle, and there's a lot more to come today. There are puddles everywhere. The ducks are out. The black swans are in the Derby Yarragon. And you and I are talking about all of these events around the world. But the state of Western Australia, at least the Treasurer, Rita Safiotti, backed by a smiling Premier Roger Cook, brought down the WA state budget in State Parliament yesterday. It's impressive, I suppose, as a financial performance document. WA's got big sort of tons, pots of money, but not everyone's happy with it. What did you make of the budget announcement?
I heard someone once describe this budget delivered yesterday for outside listeners in Western Australia as a boring budget. And given everything that you just talked about, we've just talked about, Michael, sometimes boring isn't too bad because it indicates that things are fairly stable and we're just getting on with it. I think the overall set of the books of Western Australia is incredibly healthy, of course, underpinned by very lucrative royalties as well, which are propping it up, of course. But there are some issues there. So the government's decided to wean households off our $400 electricity subsidy, which will impact on people. There is still support for low-income earners on around their electricity bills, but household charges continue to go up. And for some people, that will be fine, but for the more vulnerable people in our community, that remains an issue. There's a lot of effort put into housing, and there is a lot of effort put into housing around the supply side, around construction, apprenticeships, etc., which won't bear fruit in the short term, but it's actually really important because we need to address supply in the housing. So that could be a 3 or 4 year project, but that investment is still a welcome one that over time should play some dividends. There's a lot of money there for infrastructure. It's a very infrastructure focused budget. I think that's probably necessary, but some environmentalists are quite unhappy that there's only bits and pieces of funding to actually tackle climate change and to properly transition to other forms of energy. So it's probably it won't keep everyone happy, but if it's a boring budget at the moment, probably that's probably not the worst thing.
Just staying with the concept of the budget, Martin, I've always thought that if I'm going to get into politics, you needed to get yourself onto an economics committee because at the end of the day, governments can't do anything if they don't have money to do it. There are some things, of course, they can change the law and affect social policy, but most of what they do has a financial consequence. I mean, how does one go about making a budget? What happens within government? Do they actually sit down and face hard choices? There's a lot of criticism, for example, from Shelter WA, from Anglicare, from the community groups who provide housing, looking after all the people who are living rough as well as the social housing problem. I mean, how do they go about it?
There's a concept in public policy we have called opportunity cost, Michael, and it's basically by funding one thing, there's another thing you can't fund. So you don't have a limitless bucket of money. Even governments don't have that. So they've got to make deliberate choices all the time about what they fund. It's at least a 6 or 7 month process. It starts a long way out. Agencies start building their case for more funding. Ministers have their pet things which they're pushing. They're consulting stakeholders in each of their areas. This one's a slightly different one because we've had an election in March. So what happened is they spent a lot of time aggregating their major promises, obviously rolled them out during the election period, plugged them as hard as they could when they were campaigning, and they're the main ones they're implementing now. So that's the sort of basis of the bigger picture ones. But there is always some fine-tuning, in the closing month or two, as they go on. But you won't find a whole range of new things suddenly jumping into a budget at the last minute. It's an iterative process over a long period of time. That sounds pretty boring, but it's just the reality of government.
The figures coming out on homelessness and that challenge, Martin, I suspect we're going to hear a lot more on. Shelter WA provided these key figures yesterday, which the Shipping News will give greater publicity to. I'm not sure I've seen them in print elsewhere. They point out that in the 2021 census, there were 9,729 people experiencing homelessness in WA, which included 2,315 people rough sleeping. And that was a 114% increase from 2016, 2016. In April this year, April 2025, there were 1,934 people rough sleeping or temporarily sheltered across the five by name list communities across Perth and the southwest. That's where the community people know who is sleeping rough. 50% of specialist homelessness services clients in WA are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders, despite making up just 3% of the population. 15% of that broader cohort are employed, up 62% over 5 years. There are currently 22,066 applications on the social housing waitlist as of 30th of April 2025, including 7,125 priority applications. And this budget will show average wait times have once again increased to 151 weeks. What a telling statistic, Martin.
They're very sobering statistics, aren't they? And they show the extent of the problem that has built up over a period of time. And it is incumbent upon governments, particularly those that do have some means, like the West Australian government, to jump in and help tackle that. That's so.
I mean, I would hate to be the politician to be, to be as open as one can be about these things. No one wants to see these figures. No one wants to see these social problems. But goodness knows, how do you actually resolve them?
Yeah, I think again it's connected to supply, and in particular, homelessness has got a strong connection with community and social housing, and its availability. Of course, there are some people who face other individual issues that are separate to that. But I think that there was some money there for social and affordable housing. It was about 246 mil. This figure sound like a lot, but if you've got 22,000 on the waiting list. It's not going to fund anything like 22,000 houses, but not that WA's construction sector could actually build that many anyway. I think I heard a figure of, and someone might correct me, it was around about 12,000 houses we're building a year, which is only a really small amount given compared to what's needed.
And to not balance the record, but to mention some of the information that has come out of the budget, there's a $6 million amount to grow community housing sector capacity. There's 20.4 million for homelessness outreach and services, and the build to rent kickstart fund. So that's an interesting one. This seems to be the latest thing around the country and elsewhere, the build to rent, and the there's a requirement that 30% of the build to rent apartments be available for social housing. Of course, it's still private sector, and there's a lot of people who remain a little cynical about how well that would work, but I guess it's a small step in possibly in the right direction.
Indeed, I think it's a positive step. Absolutely. So, look, there's bits and pieces there. It's fair to acknowledge that some of those issues take an extended period of time, but we've got to chip away at that problem. It's a massive problem, and it deserves attention.
Yeah. There is in fact 75 million going into this build to rent kickstart fund designed to deliver around 400 long-term rental homes with a requirement of at least 30% affordable rentals. So it's I mean they look small and they are, but at least they're going in the right direction. Martin, it's been a bit of a depressing chat today, apart from the Dockers winning.
Oh, look, I think, like I said, a boring budget overall is not necessarily the worst thing. So I think that's we can be grateful in that respect, but I think it's a reminder of people not doing so well and trying to think about what the solutions are there. That's what budget should be all about, developing our economy, but not forgetting vulnerable people in our community and how we can assist them.
Martin, on that sober note, we'll bring View from the Roundhouse to an end today. Goodness knows what will be going on in Trump world during the week, but particularly in the next 2 weeks. Do you think something dramatic's going to happen? Would you be prepared to lay odds, sort of 60-40?
I'll give you a 60-40. Now, Trump is unpredictable. That's why a 60-40 is better than asking for 90-10 here, Michael. I think it's probably 60% more likely he tries to cut a deal. I think it's in Iran's interest to try and cut a deal. They're not in great shape. Their military forces are not in great shape. They've taken a bit of a pounding. Every regime is interested in self-preservation, Michael. That will be a factor, I suspect. I think Russia would rather see the Iranian regime stay. It's an unpleasant regime, Michael. But I tell you, 92 million people. What could happen if you had anarchy and complete void of government in Iran? We've seen Iraq, we've seen Afghanistan. So yeah, I think it's 60-40 that he tries to cut a deal rather than strikes.
Thanks, Martin, for your sober reflections and your wise observations. We'll talk all about it again next Friday. See you then.